With a tense Cold War standoff crackling on the eastern edges of Ukraine, the Islamic State tearing up the map of the Middle East and forcing U.S. troops back into Iraq, and Boko Haram insurgents repeatedly capturing and killing Nigerian schoolchildren, many of us wish for some thread to help explain such tumultuous events. In her new book, Thieves of State, Why Corruption Threatens Global Security, Sarah Chase finds one: acute public corruption. Sarah Chase is an award-winning former NPR correspondent, foreign policy expert, and entrepreneur with 10 years' experience in Afghanistan. She is now senior associate at the Carnegie Endowment and author of The Punishment of Virtue. Again, the new book is Thieves of State, Why Corruption Threatens Global Security. And it's a great pleasure to welcome Sarah Chase to the roundtable this morning. Thank you very much for being with us.
Thanks for having me, Joe.
Very nice to have you with us. The subtitle of the book, Why Corruption Threatens Global Security. What brought you to that topic of wanting to look at this specifically?
Living it. I lived in southern Afghanistan in Kandahar, the former Taliban stronghold, for nearly a decade. And it really became clear to me early on that what was beginning to drive Afghans back into the arms of the Taliban, which they really had repudiated by 2001, was the abusive, humiliating, corrupt practices of the Afghan government. And to some extent, the United States was being held accountable for this, because Afghans said, look, you guys brought this government back here and we gave it a chance, but look at how it's behaving. And so when you have villagers who were, you know, often they would say to me, look, the Taliban shake me down at night, and the government shakes me down in the daytime. I mean, why would they take risks to prevent the Taliban from, you know, making inroads on behalf of a government that, you know, was really treating them just as badly? And then I made this argument in early 2010 to a group of, you know, 250 military and police officers from 45 countries. I was giving a talk on the opium economy of southern Afghanistan, but I couldn't resist at the end saying, look, opium's just part of a bigger problem. Opium is just one revenue stream that has been captured by, frankly, what's functioning as a very effective criminal organization, which is known as the government of Afghanistan, right? And to my amazement, this room full of people kind of erupted positively, and people came down afterwards and said, wow, you just described my country. And as I looked at who was coming down and telling me this, I noticed there was an extremist insurgency in every single one of these countries. So I said, wow, this story isn't just about Afghanistan. This correlation is quite pervasive across the globe. And this was early 2010, before the Arab Spring, before Ukraine, before ISIS takes over half of Iraq. Boko Haram was, you know, emerging, but nothing like it is today. And so if anything, I feel like recent events have only confirmed this hypothesis.
So let us begin with a very basic, and perhaps this is overly simplistic, but a definition of corruption, of how you define corruption in this case?
That's a great question. And my answer is ask the people who are suffering from it. It's not for me to define corruption. But what I found quite interesting is that in places that Westerners often describe as, quote, culturally corrupt, residents of those countries have no problem defining what corruption is. Sometimes you get quite colorful narratives. For example, in Afghanistan, once somebody told me, when the district governor keeps all of the development resources for himself and surrounds himself with armed thugs so that the people can't come to him to lodge their legitimate complaints, that's corruption. Well, I find that a pretty, you know, a pretty evocative description of the problem. But more generally, it is the abuse of public office for personal gain.
I am talking to you from Albany, New York, where right now, the Speaker of the State Assembly is being arrested for charges of corruption. So my question is, have we become so used to it in our society and in our world culture that it's not even something that is often on our radar as it should be?
I couldn't agree with you more, and I think the problem in the United States is twofold. So we have a case like the one you mentioned where the Speaker of the Assembly is arrested, where we have, you know, the governor of the state of Virginia was recently convicted. So we do have rule of law institutions that catch what we tend to see as individual bad actors. Even in that regard, I think the definition of corruption in the United States has gotten dangerously narrowed. In the governor of Virginia case, the big issue was there a, quote, quid pro quo? That is to say, practically, was there a contract between the bribe giver and the bribe taker? Well, anyone who knows how politics works in this country or elsewhere knows that it's way subtler than that. It's a kind of gift economy. And so I would say in the United States, we're facing what some might call a situation of legalized corruption, where really preponderant influence over the political process is being exercised by, I would say, four major industries in this country: the defense industry, the energy industry, the health industry, and Wall Street. And, you know, you don't have explicit quid pro quo bribery going on, but you do have the excessive impact of private interests on the political process. But secondly, your question is really interesting because in those countries in the world where the connection to real violence, like revolution and regime change or the rise of violent extremism, seems so clear to me, I was really struck at what a difficult time U.S. officials had taking corruption seriously as a driver of these types of security crises. And as you suggest, it seems that, you know, American officials tend to see corruption as a kind of victimless crime, a sort of odorless gas that we don't really notice. But odorless gases can sometimes explode. And I think that's what's going on here.
Certainly, listeners to this radio station and to National Public Radio probably recognize your voice. You were a reporter for many years on NPR, covering the fall of the Taliban. And then you decided to leave your journalism career and to stay in Afghanistan. What led to that decision to stay there and try to make a difference in this very field, to try to clean up corruption and to help the people on the ground?
Two things. One, and I suspect this is a tension that many journalists suffer, it feels sometimes like a pretty irresponsible profession in the sense that you make your living describing events that are often really dramatic for the people living through them. But you spend, you know, a few days or a few weeks on this event or on a particular story, as it were, and it's a story, right? You move on to the next one. And for me, it was really becoming difficult to live with myself with, you know, just not taking any responsibility at all for how things turned out. So that was part of it. That was a feeling that had been growing inside me for quite some time. But secondly, the immediate post 9/11 juncture just seemed so incredibly important historically. It seemed like one of those real crises from which enormous opportunity can emerge. And it seemed to me that, you know, Islam and the West, if you can talk about two such complex realities, you know, in such simplistic words, but these two civilizations, you know, we're on this planet together and we, you know, neither of us is going away and we're going to have to figure out how to see the world a little bit better from each other's perspectives and to identify all of the great stuff we have to learn from and teach each other. And it seemed to me that moment of crisis was an extraordinary opportunity to further that type of more constructive interaction. I'm not sure we've gotten very far, but that really is what drove me to stay in Afghanistan.
What I think is fascinating about your book is that you show how one thing here and one thing there and this happening to the right of this village and this thing happening to the left of the village, of eventually how all of this works together until it becomes really a system. And it's a policy and a protocol that is destroying the people.
I think that's, thank you for that, because I do feel that that's one of the most important sort of insights that I came to over the course of, you know, 7-8 years. It didn't strike me immediately in these terms. And in fact, it didn't look like this initially. And what I'd say is I didn't actually go to address the problem of corruption because I didn't know there was a problem of corruption. I went to try to do much more standard, you know, development work. And it was the Afghans' indignation at the corruption around them that really drove me to invest myself into the issue. And the point was, as you describe it, that at first it was a kind of ad hoc shaking people down. But over time, those types of behaviors began to crystallize into what I can only describe as a vertically integrated, you know, criminal system. And what that meant was that money was being stolen or resources extracted at the bottom, and it was being sent up the line in the form of purchase of office. For example, if you want to be a district police chief, you pay about $50,000 plus a monthly, in the form of just straight kickbacks, in the form of gifts being sent to superiors and things like that. And in return, what goes down the system is a sort of unfettered permission to steal money any way you can get your hands on it, and also, most importantly, protection from repercussions. And this really is how a mafia works, right? The guys at the ground level, the ones collecting the money, they send it up, and in return, you know, you are protected from arrest, from intimidation, from, you know, you get the best lawyers and things like that. And, you know, a mafia is a system that selects for criminality by promoting the most effective criminals, by sloughing off or expelling or even killing the people who might make a problem, meaning people of integrity. And that's what I watched happening within the Afghan government over time.
Sarah Chase is the author of the new book, Thieves of State: Why Corruption Threatens Global Security. The book is published by Norton. So what is fascinating about this book is that you look at these issues, and certainly using the Afghan experience as a baseline. But as you mentioned moments ago, around the globe and what we are dealing with now of issues with the Islamic State, Boko Haram, what is happening in the world as we speak? And we often throw up our hands and say, okay, but what do we do about it? And you see this on so many levels in our government and others of saying, okay, but what is the right thing to do? And many of us simply say, well, we don't know what the quote-unquote right thing is to do. You offer several ideas in the book as at least starting points of what we can do. And I'm hoping in our time remaining, we can outline some of this, of how you reached some conclusions as to where we need to be and what road, at least, we should be traveling on.
Indeed. The first thing I'd say is that once a security crisis has broken out, it's really hard to get that genie back into the bottle. So the first, you know, the really important thing to remember is the old an ounce of prevention, right? And that means taking corruption seriously upstream of a hot security crisis. So if you take a country like Tunisia in 2010, everyone thought, you know, strong man, strong country, no problem. Transparency International had Tunisia, you know, sort of in the middle of the pack, not as one of the most corrupt countries. And so nobody ever thought about how the U.S. government and U.S. businesses ought to be interacting with a country like Nigeria. Once you're to, you know, ISIS owning half of the country, it's really difficult to address those problems. Nevertheless, I would say that For example, the U.S. government, which repeatedly says there is no military solution to violent extremism, why is it that we've spent so much of our effort thinking about the military solution in Iraq? Why haven't we gone beyond the mere question of it being Abadi instead of Maliki as prime minister to, okay, what is Prime Minister Abadi doing to genuinely engage Sunnis in their collective destiny as Iraq? What is he doing to roll back some of the kleptocratic structuring that Maliki introduced into governing functions, Abadi needs our military support. That gives us leverage to demand some of these types of changes. It means things like, you know, visa denials and seizure of assets, not just once a country becomes a pariah or a leader becomes a pariah like Ukraine's Yanukovych or Hosni Mubarak, but upstream of when the corruption has gotten so bad as to produce a revolution. So what I did in the book was provide a kind of toolbox of different leverage that's available to different government and private sector actors. I'm not giving a specific recipe for a specific country in that book because, you know, the particularities of every situation, the political trade-offs involved are quite distinct. But at least I tried to show that it's not like there's nothing we can do about this. It's a question of having the skill, the subtlety, and the courage to make use of the leverage.
As you say, there are very distinct situations here, and there are different ways that we can go about this. What I find in just hosting this show day to day, when we do our panel discussion, there is the listener, and it happens almost every time we discuss this, who is going to write in and say, okay, look, I don't want to be the cynic. However, as long as big oil and as long as oil is on the table, as long as we have arms sales on the table, how much do we think is going to be taken care of here? And I'm just curious as to, A, how much you see that cynicism on the ground, and B, how much of that is actually the elephant in the room?
There is a lot of that cynicism, and I would add a third point, which is, frankly, the intelligence community, in particular the CIA, which has kind of restructured itself as a targeting organization.
Right.
And so much of the intelligence that's gathered is really looking for hot targets who can be killed. What's really interesting is the intelligence community, and I have had this conversation with some pretty senior officials, they were pretty candid in saying, look, we don't even collect against this issue. We don't analyze systematically these governments in the same terms that we might even be analyzing transnational organized crime. So we're not actually even looking at this. And those are really important issues. But I would say in this context that's part of why I wrote this book is we are underestimating how dangerous this phenomenon is. And if we understood it better, we might actually begin to be changing our priorities. The second thing I'd like to say is with respect to oil, things are changing really fast. Since last summer, for example, the United States refineries are no longer importing Nigerian oil. That gives us a lot of new leverage in terms of how we interact with the Nigerian government. So it's really important to watch how some of these political trade-offs are evolving, because they do evolve.
Again, looking at the subtitle of the book, of Why Corruption Threatens Global Security, do you believe it will always be a threat, or is there a shred of optimism in you?
Looking historically, you see that, you know, the intensity of corruption, both in this country and the world, rises and falls over time. I mean, we lived through a Gilded Age, which was eventually succeeded by a really powerful reformist progressive movement. Unfortunately, I feel like we've been living in a kind of second Gilded Age, both in the United States and our own culture having repercussions in the rest of the world since about the 1980s, and I think that we're still in it. I'm not sure what it's going to take to cause us to kind of wake up and start a new wave of reform, but I do have confidence in the human spirit and in the very deep human hunger for justice, and that makes me feel that it can't go on like this forever.
When you think of it not going on forever, you do have to wonder, and I kept on thinking about this as I was reading the book, of, okay, but, you know, if not this, what? You know, what's the tipping point going to be?
Yeah, it's a really good question. What's the tipping point going to be both at home and abroad? I mean, we are living in this country a really unprecedented level of private influence over the conduct of public affairs. And, you know, it's really interesting to go back to even the notes of the Constitutional Convention and see how incredibly sophisticated the framers of our Constitution were in understanding what the realities of potential corruption looked like. And in some ways, you can see our Constitution as being like a gigantic corruption prevention mechanism. And I think they did a great job. And I think we've really been straying in this country. And frankly, U.S. Culture does permeate and pervade the rest of the world. And so what I've found as I've looked, you know, as I've talked to people in Nigeria, in Uzbekistan, in Arab Spring countries, I've asked all of them, you know, was there a time, is there a date when this thing went off the rails? And they all have a year, or more or less a year. And it's almost always in the late 1990s. And the hypothesis that I have is that there was a kind of gigantic shift in public ethics that was driven in large part by kind of Reagan and Thatcher and the fall of the communist world, as it were. Not that that wasn't an incredibly hypocritical sort of structure, but there was at least some ethos of relatively equitable distribution of resources. When that collapsed, it was like there were no more restraints. And that's what a lot of people, particularly in the former Soviet space, but also in North Africa and the Middle East, have been telling me. So I just don't know what it's going to take. I don't know what degree of damage to our societies it's going to take before we really stand up for ourselves as citizens.
Sarah Chase is the author of the new book, Thieves of State: Why Corruption Threatens Global Security. The book is published by Norton. Sarah, thank you so much for sharing your expertise with us this morning. I greatly appreciate it.
Thank you, Joe. Great questions.
Thank you. Again, the title of the book, Thieves of State: Why Corruption Threatens Global Security. Sarah Chase is the author. Norton is the publisher. You're listening to The Roundtable on WAMC.